Wisconsin Department of Corrections. Mr. Moriarty.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. Mr. Teller raises jurisdictional issues. We believe those are fully addressed in the written submissions, but if there's any questions about jurisdiction, that being a primary issue, I want to make sure that we, if there's any questions on the jurisdiction, that we address those first. There's not. The end result in this case, then, which can be reached by many different routes, is the same.
Mr. Moriarty, I want to begin by pointing out that one of the routes that you urge in your brief proceeds on the basis of a mistaken view about Supreme Court opinions. There's a very significant difference that has existed since at least the 1940s in Supreme Court practice between an opinion that's a concurring opinion and an opinion that concurs in the judgment, which is why, for example, in Hibbs at the beginning, it says, Chief Justice Rehnquist delivered the opinion of the court, capital C, because three justices, in particular Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer, joined Justice Rehnquist's opinion, Justice Souter, with whom Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer joined, concurring. So he had five votes for that opinion. They added a few extra words. They said, we agree with everything you said in your opinion, and moreover, we have even something else to say. Justice Stevens, on the other hand, concurred in the judgment, so he's not part of the majority. But Hibbs is most certainly an opinion of the court, as the heading in the U.S. report shows, opinion of the court. And you can see in other cases where there are only concurring in the judgment opinions for a certain result, the court doesn't label it that way. The court labels it opinion of Justice Rehnquist or opinion of Justice Scalia or opinion of Justice whomever. However your argument proceeds, I think you have to proceed on the basis of the fact that Hibbs is an opinion of the court. Every word that Justice Rehnquist says in that opinion is an opinion of the court, and what we need to focus on is whether that opinion, which, as he says, addresses whether an individual may sue a state for money damages in federal court for violation of 2612A1 capital C, also applies to the A1 capital D.
Yes, Your Honor, I acknowledge everything that you've said. And also, no.
But your brief didn't. Your brief goes on for about 10 pages about
the reason for that, Your Honor, is the reason for that, Your Honor, is that the end result is the same regardless of your answer to the Marx inquiry. But
it's not a Marx case. That's what I'm trying to tell you. This case has nothing to do with Marx.
Well, you have. I appreciate that view. But if you look closely at the opinion, the concurring opinion that supposedly brings this together, there are problems with it.
No, it's a concurring opinion. They join, unless you're telling the Supreme Court that they don't know what they're doing. Justice Rehnquist has an opinion of the court. This
is
not a Marx case. If that's what the court said.
Your Honor, that may be the end result that this panel reaches. But
look, I don't want you to argue that an opinion that's a concurring opinion is not an opinion that's a join for the other opinions. It's just not right as a matter of Supreme Court practice.
I would simply point out, Your Honor, that the court, this panel, has a duty to do a Marx
inquiry. We have a duty to follow things that say opinion of the court. If this court starts going on saying Justice Rehnquist didn't do an opinion of the court, we will be slapped down.
Where there's a splintered opinion,
it's not a splintered opinion case.
And it may be that that's what this panel will decide.
This is the same misunderstanding of Brand that gave rise to a lot of silly opinions about reporters' privilege. We have a majority opinion. You have a concurrence, which joins the majority. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, as soon as you put two opinions together, you can sense, tensions, mm-hmm. right? But you can't use that to knock out the majority opinion. Right. Otherwise, just too chaotic.
If that's what the panel reaches, I am perfectly satisfied with that. I wanted to raise the issue
so
that the court had it. And
so
it's in the briefs.
And it's on the briefs. Don't raise it again that way, though, because it's just not
Let's then
open
turn to
us.
Other routes that the court can use to get to this end result, and the end result is that Mr. Teller's family and medical leave claims, being grounded solely on his own health conditions, are barred by Wisconsin's immunity. One route that you reach that end result is simply avoiding inter-circuit conflict. This is.
But let's have a merits argument, because I think, you know, you may well be right. I mean, the self-care provisions look different from the other three, and I think there's a lot of language in Hibbs that focuses on family leave. On the other hand, the Family and Medical Leave Act, Hibbs says, is passed as an aspect of gender discrimination. And there's a lot of language in the legislative history suggesting that Congress is very concerned about the discrimination gap for self-care left after the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, that there was a stereotype on the part of employers that female employees would be taking lots of time off because they were pregnant, and so on. And the way to cure that was simply to say everybody gets self-care, just as the way to cure the stereotype that women are caregivers is to say that all caregivers, Mr. Hibbs, of course, was not a woman, and he was taking care of his wife, but the court says that. So I would appreciate some merits focus on the legislative concern with pregnancy in particular, and there are many, many quotes in the legislative history about that. You didn't really address that in your reply brief, even though Mr. Toler talked about it, and how we're to deal with that.
Well, I do think we did address it in the briefs,
particularly by talking about the
Tavel case and how it analyzed those very issues and that very legislative history.
Well, but how about pregnancy? You didn't talk – the Tavel case does not focus. Judge Boggs' opinion there does not focus.
At page 33 of the initial brief, we have an extensive quote from the Tavel case that addresses precisely the pregnancy-related conditions in the FMLA legislative history and how Tavel – looked at that, analyzed it, and determined there is no legislative history supporting a conclusion that Congress's concerns about pregnancy-related conditions meant that it was finding enough evidence to abrogate sovereign immunity.
Well, I mean, we have in the Senate report the statement, employers might find it cost-effective to discriminate against married women of childbearing age since these women would end up costing a firm more than they contribute. We have a statement in the House report, the consequences of discriminatory employment practices on pregnant women and women in general has historically had a persistent and harmful effect on their careers. Women are still subject to the stereotype and so on. They're actually... another statement in the Senate report, the bill treats all employees who are temporarily unable to work due to serious health conditions in the same fashion, so it doesn't create the risk of discrimination against pregnant women.
I see my white light is on. I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
Answer the question.
Please tell me
why that is not the same kind of evidence that the court relied on in Hibbs.
The family evidence care. That the Hibbs court looked at for family leave was... Here we have a caregiver, primarily women, taking care of others. That's traditional. That's in the record. We also have women being subject to birth and pregnancy, and they have to take family leave for that. These things have – that's all established. But the evidence established, as the Tavel case indicated, that men and women pretty much equally take –
That's what the court said, but Congress is talking about the stereotype that women employees uniquely become pregnant. We can at least agree on that. And they are the ones who are going to – we don't want employers to have a disincentive to hire them thinking they're going to be taking too much self-care. I grant you that Tavel doesn't focus on that much, but we have a responsibility
absolutely.
Also.
The Tavel case, though, did point out – that this could feed, if there was a disparity along that lines, this could feed the very stereotypes that create the problem. But that
doesn't make sense to me at all. To have a non-discriminatory provision.
I see my orange light is on.
Yeah,
if I could reserve for rebuttal.
Look, would you answer her question, please? If
certainly,
you need more time, I'll give you more time.
Okay, fine. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry for that. And the question is, on the pregnancy-related conditions, is there legislative history sufficient to have validly abrogated 11th Amendment immunity? I think if the record is examined, there is not. There are references, scattered references in the congressional record to pregnancy-related conditions. Most of that has to do with the family leave provision.
When you're pregnant, you don't have a family yet. You're just you, pregnant.
No, but family leave is allowed because you're pregnant or because you're going
to
get
childbirth.
Why isn't
that under the self-care leave? Pregnant woman,
there are
no children yet. You think they're taking family leave?
Family leave can be allowed in relation to the time before birth as well as after birth, yes.
Well, so. I don't know.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Moriarty. You. Mr. Mihalich?
May it please the court. The self-care provision is congruent to eliminate sex-based stereotypes.
Yeah, but you know what the problem I have with that is? There is this mention, you know, in the Senate report, but it seems to be only a little piece. Now, so wouldn't your argument be that if it were, you know, not pregnancy or anything like that, but cancer, it would still, you know, abrogate the 11th Amendment?
I don't think so.
Well, see, I have that same issue, in fact, because there are some aspects of self-care that may fall within this argument, but many others, for men or women alike, cancer, flu, you know, what have you, that don't seem to have anything to do with it and that make this case look much more like Garrett.
Well, I think a big part of the analysis is pregnancy. And
so you have to free ride everything else along with the fact that one very small percentage of self-care needs is pregnancy. Isn't that kind of the tail wagging the dog?
No, I don't think so. I think that pregnancy is such an overriding concern for Congress when they enacted the statute that they were trying to eliminate discrimination. Most employers that Congress felt, when they're making a decision between hiring a male and a female, they will go with the male if they have a sex-based stereotype that the woman would become pregnant and incapacitated for some period of time. So I think that is the primary basis.
Your argument was different, that they would prefer the man because the Pregnancy Discrimination Act would make it more difficult to fire the woman.
Well, that's why Congress enacted the FMLA, because that failed to achieve the result that they desired under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. And that's why Congress got it right when they enacted the FMLA this time, because they specifically stated, look, we are trying to...
But that doesn't bear on the medical leave, does it? Or?
I think it does. It has a spillover effect, because the question is, when does a pregnancy become a serious health condition or family leave? Who can draw the line specifically?
Well, see, under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, for an individual woman who's pregnant, the pregnancy has to be treated just like any other disability she has. She broke her leg, you know, she has whatever. Which makes me think that at least if you're just talking about one woman who's pregnant, then she's not taking quote-unquote family leave. She's taking subpart D, self-care leave. I mean, usually employers, for most other purposes, don't need to figure out which subsection of the family. I've never seen, actually, an employment manual that said, are you taking part A, B, C, or D leave? But your problem in terms of the 11th Amendment point is that the subpart D looks like measures that a person takes to care for their own, shall we say, temporary disability, which makes it look more like a Garrett situation.
Yes, that is true.
And to be consistent with Garrett, we would have to say the states have 11th Amendment immunity, would we not?
I don't think so. I think that's where the distinction lies, is that Congress went back and repaired the problem that resulted from the Pregnancy Discrimination Act and finding that it's necessary to have a broad-based medical and family leave provision applies to all.
What does Toler's case have to do with sex discrimination?
Well, I would say Mr. Teller is a bit player in the big stage that is now before this court, because he's under the self-care provision. And in order to successfully abrogate.
But most of the litigation, if you prevail, will have nothing to do with sex discrimination, right?
Just in this particular case,
people who are ill.
That's correct.
But then it seems so remote from a concern with discrimination. I don't understand.
Well, I think you're correct in the fact that Mr. Teller is a male.
The question, in a sense, is going back to Hibbs, which is certainly important guidance for us here. There we see the court talking about the idea that women are usually caregivers, and yet in the Hibbs case, it's Mr. Hibbs who's trying to get FMLA leave to care for his ailing wife. So he wasn't that stereotypical female caregiver either.
Correct.
But going on, it's logical to think that over time, especially, you're going to have something close to 50-50, or if not that, at least a third of the people taking family care leave might be male, even if two-thirds are female, whereas maybe 1% of the people taking the self-care will be pregnant women, and the other 99 will be men or women who have whatever their health problem is. You see what I'm saying? I think there's sort of a different balance, which may be of importance.
I think that's true, and I think that the overriding concern of Congress was to alleviate any danger of stereotyping, so that if you're an employer, you don't want to hire a female that may have complications from pregnancy.
But how could have that been the overriding purpose of the medical leave? I don't understand. I mean, you're eating. You want to eat deeply into state prerogatives in controlling their employees and so on. And you really have a tail wagging the dog problem.
I don't agree, Your Honor. I think that, as Congress has stated, that was the overriding concern of Congress.
With the self-care was overridingly concerned with sex discrimination?
Yes.
How so?
Because self-care is so related to pregnancy.
Wait. I don't understand you.
Allow me to explain.
As Judge Wood just said, most problems people have are not pregnancy. Most physical problems are not pregnancy. They're other ailments.
No, but the concern of Congress was that employer...
But I understand. If their concern was sex discrimination, why would they have a medical leave statute or provision of a statute that applied to all ailments?
Because with pregnancy becomes many self-care-related issues, morning sickness, back problems.
Yes, but you have, if we use Judge Wood's statistics, we have 99 times as many self-care problems with unrelated ailments, unrelated to pregnancy.
Well, we're not
so
talking...
So why should the state be bound to deal with people like Toler? His case has absolutely no conceivable connection to pregnancy.
The concern is perceptions and stereotypes of employers.
Of what? Is it a perception that women are less healthy than men?
Yes. The concern is that women can become pregnant, and
no,
with pregnancy...
No, women can become pregnant. But if you look at all the illnesses that workers have, including morning sickness... Well, you know, men have prostate problems, right? So is it true that somehow women are perceived as the sickly sex by employers?
No, I think that employers perceive women, again, to get pregnant, and with pregnancy comes related issues. And
but
I think that's the stereotype that Congress is attempting to alleviate.
Let me come at it in a somewhat different way. What the court has spoken about in cases from City of Bernie against Flores forward is this idea of congruence and proportionality. So my question would be, even if, and as I believe there is, a lot of reference in the legislative history to Congress putting in the self-care provisions because they had this pregnancy notion, we already know that Congress fully intended in this statute to abrogate state sovereign immunity. The real question is, can they do it legitimately under Section 5? And if you have this, you know, my rough statistics, you know, 1%, 99% balance, is it a congruent and proportional response to to impose this obligation in a way that's enforceable through money damage actions on the states, or is it something that goes over the line that the court has drawn in these earlier cases?
Well, I think that Hibbs addresses that with regard to the family portion of it.
With regard to the family portion, where the balance may be different and where congruence and proportionality may be met. The question is, can you make the case it's also met on self-care?
Yes. I think that if the purpose of Congress was to alleviate the stereotypes that come with pregnancy and health-related issues, then it is proportionate.
But wouldn't that have to have been a minor purpose so far as the medical leave is concerned?
I don't think so. I think that it was a major purpose.
That was the major purpose? Then why did they just limit it to pregnancy-related ailments? Why did they sweep in the whole range of illnesses that people get?
Well, I think they stated in Hibbs that they wanted a broad-based, across-the-board ability for men and women to take medical leave for their own conditions and their family members without any distinction.
No. Family members. We're not talking about family members. Don't you understand that?
Yes. Talking about self-care.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mihalich. Do you have anything further, Mr. Moriarty?
Yes, sir.
All right. We'll give you a minute.
The Senate report listed 13 other conditions in addition to pregnancy-related conditions. They had already addressed the problem through the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. They were not addressing the problem here, and they certainly were not addressing any discrimination against women by states regarding pregnancy-related conditions. We would ask the case be vacated, the decision below be vacated, remanded for judgment for the defendant. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Next case for argument is United States versus Charles.